feel. If some future AI system is conscious, then what will it subjectively experience? This is the essence of the even harder problem of consciousness, and forces us up to the second level of difficulty in our pyramid of hard problems. Not only do we currently lack a theory that answers this question, but we're not even sure whether it's logically possible to fully answer it. After all, what could a satisfactory answer sound like? How would you explain to a person born blind what the color red looks like? Fortunately, our current inability to give a complete answer doesn't prevent us from giving partial answers. An intelligent alien studying the human sensory system would probably infer that colors are qualia that feel associated with each point on a two-dimensional surface, our visual field, while sounds don't feel as spatially localized, and pains are qualia that feel associated with different parts of our body. From discovering that our retinas have three types of light-sensitive cone cells, they could infer that we experience three primary colors and that all other color qualia result from combining them. By measuring how long it takes neurons to transmit information across the brain, they could conclude that we experience no more than about 10 conscious thoughts or perceptions per second, and that when we watch movies on our TV at 24 frames per second, we experience this not as a sequence of still images, but as continuous motion. From measuring how fast adrenaline is released into our bloodstream and how long it remains before being broken down, they could predict that we feel bursts of anger starting within seconds and lasting for minutes. Applying similar physics-based arguments, we can make some educated guesses about certain aspects of how an artificial consciousness may feel. First of all, the space of possible AI experiences is huge compared to what we humans can experience. We have one class of qualia for each of our senses, but AIs can have vastly more types of sensors and internal representations of information, so we must avoid the pitfall of assuming that being an AI necessarily feels similar to being a person. Second, a brain-sized artificial consciousness could have millions of times more experiences than us per second, since electromagnetic signals travel at the speed of light, millions of times faster than neuron signals. However, the larger the AI, the slower its global thoughts must be to allow information time to flow between all its parts, as we heard in Chapter 4. We therefore expect an Earth-sized Gaia AI to have only about 10 conscious experiences per second, like a human, and a galaxy-sized AI could have only one global thought every 100,000 years or so. So no more than about 100 experiences during the entire history of our universe thus far. This would give large AIs a seemingly irresistible incentive to delegate computations to the smallest subsystems capable of handling them, to speed things up, much like our conscious mind has delegated the blink reflex to a small, fast, and unconscious subsystem. Although we heard previously that the conscious information processing in our brains appears to be merely the tip of an otherwise unconscious iceberg, we should expect the situation to be even more extreme for large future AIs. If they have a single consciousness, then it's likely to be unaware of almost all the information processing taking place within it. Moreover, although the conscious experiences that it enjoys may be extremely complex, they're also snail-paced compared to the rapid activities of its smaller parts. This really brings to a head the aforementioned controversy about whether parts of a conscious entity can be conscious too. IIT predicts not, which means that if a future astronomically large AI is conscious, then almost all its information processing is unconscious. This would mean that if a civilization of smaller AIs improves its communication abilities to the point that a single conscious hive mind emerges, their much faster individual consciousnesses are suddenly extinguished. If the IIT prediction is wrong, on the other hand, the hive mind can coexist with the panoply of smaller conscious minds. Indeed, one could even imagine a nested hierarchy of consciousnesses at all levels, from microscopic to cosmic. As we heard previously, the unconscious information processing in our human brains appears linked to the effortless, fast, and automatic way of thinking that psychologists call System 1. For example, your System 1 might inform your consciousness that its highly complex analysis of visual input data has determined that your best friend has arrived, without giving you any idea how the computation took place. If this link between systems and consciousness proves to be valid, then it will be tempting to generalize this terminology to AIs, denoting all rapid routine tasks delegated to unconscious subunits as the AI's System 1. The effortful, slow, and controlled global thinking of the AI would, if conscious, be the AI's System 2. We humans also have conscious experiences involving what I'll term System 0, raw, passive perception that takes place even when you sit without moving or thinking and merely observe the world around you. Systems 0, 1, and 2 seem progressively more complex, so it's striking that only the middle one appears unconscious. IIT explains this by saying that raw sensory information in System 0 is stored in grid-like brain structures with very high integration, while System 2 has high integration because of feedback loops, where all the information you're aware of right now can affect your future brain states. On the other hand, it was precisely the conscious grid prediction that triggered Scott Aronson's aforementioned IIT critique. In summary, if a theory solving the pretty hard problem of consciousness can one day pass a rigorous battery of experimental tests so that we start taking its predictions seriously, then it will also greatly narrow down the options for the even harder problem of what future conscious AIs may experience. Some aspects of our subjective experience clearly trace back to our evolutionary origins. For example, our emotional desires related to self-preservation, eating, drinking, avoiding getting killed, and reproduction. This means that it should be possible to create AI that never experiences qualia such as hunger, thirst, fear, or sexual desire. As we heard in the last chapter, if a highly intelligent AI is programmed to have virtually any sufficiently ambitious goal, it's likely to strive for self-preservation in order to be able to accomplish that goal. If they're part of a society of AIs, however, they might lack our strong human fear of death. As long as they've backed themselves up, all they stand to lose are the memories they've accumulated since their most recent backup, as long as they're confident that their backed-up software will be used. In addition, the ability to readily copy information and software between AIs would probably reduce the strong sense of individuality that's so characteristic of our human consciousness. There would be less of a distinction between you and me if we could easily share and copy all our memories and abilities, so a group of nearby AIs may feel more like a single organism with a hive mind. Would an artificial consciousness feel that it had free will? Note that, although philosophers have spent millennia quibbling about whether we have free will without reaching consensus even on how to define the question, I'm asking a different question, which is arguably easier to tackle. Let me try to persuade you that the answer is simply, yes, any conscious decision maker will subjectively feel that it has free will, regardless of whether it's biological or artificial. Decisions fall on a spectrum between two extremes. One, you know exactly why you made that particular choice. Two, you have no idea why you made that particular choice. It felt like you chose randomly on a whim. Free will discussions usually center around a struggle to reconcile our goal-oriented decision-making behavior with the laws of physics. If you're choosing between the following two explanations for what you did, then which one is correct? I asked her on a date because I really liked her, or my particles made me do it by moving according to the laws of physics. But we heard in the last chapter that both are correct. What feels like goal-oriented behavior can emerge from goal-less deterministic laws of physics. More specifically, when a system, brain or AI, makes a decision of type 1, it computes what to decide using some deterministic algorithm, and the reason it feels like it decided is that it in fact did decide when computing what to do. Moreover, as emphasized by Seth Lloyd, there's a famous computer science theorem saying that for almost all computations, there's no faster way of determining their outcome than actually running them. This means that it's typically impossible for you to figure out what you'll decide to do in a second, in less than a second, which helps reinforce your experience of having free will. In contrast, when a system, brain or AI, makes a decision of type 2, it simply programs its mind to base its decision on the output of some subsystem that acts as a random number generator. In brains and computers, effectively random numbers are easily generated by amplifying noise. Regardless of where on the spectrum from 1 to 2 a decision falls, both biological and artificial consciousnesses therefore feel that they have free will. They feel that it is really they who decide, and they can't predict with certainty what the decision will be until they've finished thinking it through. Some people tell me that they find causality degrading, that it makes their thought processes meaningless, and that it renders them mere machines. I find such negativity absurd and unwarranted. First of all, there's nothing mere about human brains, which, as far as I'm concerned, are the most amazingly sophisticated physical objects in our known universe. Second, what alternative would they prefer? Don't they want it to be their own thought processes, the computations performed by their brains, that make their decisions? Their subjective experience of free will is simply how their computations feel from inside. They don't know the outcome of a computation until they've finished it. That's what it means to say that the computation is the decision. Meaning. Let's end by returning to the starting point of this book. How do we want the future of life to be? We heard in the previous chapter how diverse cultures around the globe all seek a future teeming with positive experiences, but that fascinatingly thorny controversies arise when seeking consensus on what should count as positive and how to make trade-offs between what's good for different life forms. But let's not let those controversies distract us from the elephant in the room. There can be no positive experiences if there are no experiences at all. That is, if there's no consciousness. In other words, without consciousness, there can be no happiness, goodness, beauty, meaning, or purpose. Just an astronomical waste of space. This implies that when people ask about the meaning of life, as if it were the job of our cosmos to give meaning to our existence, they're getting it backward. It's not our universe giving meaning to conscious beings, but conscious beings giving meaning to our universe. So the very first goal on our wish list for the future should be retaining and hopefully expanding biological and/or artificial consciousness in our cosmos, rather than driving it extinct. If we succeed in this endeavor, then how will we humans feel about coexisting with ever smarter machines? Does the seemingly inexorable rise of artificial intelligence bother you, and if so, why? In Chapter 3, we heard how it should be relatively easy for AI-powered technology to satisfy our basic needs, such as security and income, as long as the political will to do so exists. However, perhaps you're concerned that being well-fed, clad, housed, and entertained isn't enough. If we're guaranteed that AI will take care of all our practical needs and desires, might we nonetheless end up feeling that we lack meaning and purpose in our lives, like well-kept zoo animals? Traditionally, we humans have often founded our self-worth on the idea of human exceptionalism, the conviction that we're the smartest entities on the planet and therefore unique and superior. The rise of AI will force us to abandon this and become more humble. But perhaps that's something we should do anyway. After all, clinging to hubristic notions of superiority over others, individuals, ethnic groups, species, and so on, has caused awful problems in the past, and may be an idea ready for retirement. Indeed, human exceptionalism hasn't only caused grief in the past, but it also appears unnecessary for human flourishing. If we discover a peaceful extraterrestrial civilization far more advanced than us in science, art, and everything else we care about, this presumably wouldn't prevent people from continuing to experience meaning and purpose in their lives. We could retain our families, friends, and broader communities, and all activities that give us meaning and purpose, hopefully having lost nothing but arrogance. As we plan our future, let's consider the meaning not only of our own lives, but also of our universe itself. Here, two of my favorite physicists, Steven Weinberg and Freeman Dyson, represent diametrically opposite views. Weinberg, who won the Nobel Prize for foundational work on the Standard Model of particle physics, famously said, "The more the universe seems comprehensible, the more it also seems pointless." Dyson, on the other hand, is much more optimistic, as we heard in Chapter 6. Although he agrees that our universe was pointless, he believes that life is now filling it with ever more meaning, with the best yet to come if life succeeds in spreading throughout the cosmos. He ended his seminal 1979 paper thus: "Is Weinberg's universe or mine closer to the truth? One day, before long, we shall know." If our universe goes back to being permanently unconscious because we drive Earth life extinct, or because we let unconscious zombie AI take over our universe, then Weinberg will be vindicated in spades. From this perspective, we see that although we've focused on the future of intelligence in this book, the future of consciousness is even more important, since that's what enables meaning. Philosophers like to go Latin on this distinction by contrasting sapience, the ability to think intelligently, with sentience, the ability to subjectively experience qualia. We humans have built our identity on being Homo sapiens, the smartest entities around. As we prepare to be humbled by ever smarter machines, I suggest that we rebrand ourselves as Homo sentience. The bottom line: there's no undisputed definition of consciousness. I use the broad and non-anthropocentric definition: consciousness equals subjective experience. Whether AIs are conscious in that sense is what matters for the thorniest ethical and philosophical problems posed by the rise of AI. Can AIs suffer? Should they have rights? Is uploading a subjective suicide? Could a future cosmos teeming with AIs be the ultimate zombie apocalypse? The problem of understanding intelligence shouldn't be conflated with three separate problems of consciousness: the pretty hard problem of predicting which physical systems are conscious, the even harder problem of predicting qualia, and the really hard problem of why anything at all is conscious. The pretty hard problem of consciousness is scientific, since a theory that predicts which of your brain processes are conscious is experimentally testable and falsifiable, while it's currently unclear how science could fully resolve the two harder problems. Neuroscience experiments suggest that many behaviors and brain regions are unconscious, with much of our conscious experience representing an after-the-fact summary of vastly larger amounts of unconscious information. Generalizing consciousness predictions from brains to machines requires a theory. Consciousness appears to require not a particular kind of particle or field, but a particular kind of information processing that's fairly autonomous and integrated, so that the whole system is rather autonomous, but its parts aren't. Consciousness might feel so non-physical because it's doubly substrate independent. If consciousness is the way information feels when being processed in certain complex ways, then it's merely the structure of the information processing that matters, not the structure of the matter doing the information processing. If artificial consciousness is possible, then the space of possible AI experiences is likely to be huge compared to what we humans can experience, spanning a vast spectrum of qualia and timescales, all sharing a feeling of having free will. Since there can be no meaning without consciousness, it's not our universe giving meaning to conscious beings, but conscious beings giving meaning to our universe. This suggests that as we humans prepare to be humbled by ever smarter machines, we take comfort mainly in being Homo sentients, not Homo sapiens. Epilogue: The Tale of the FLI Team. The saddest aspect of life right now is that science gathers knowledge faster than society gathers wisdom. Isaac Asimov. Here we are, my dear listener, at the end of the book, after exploring the origin and fate of intelligence, goals, and meaning. So how can we translate these ideas into action? What concretely should we do to make our future as good as possible? This is precisely the question I'm asking myself right now, as I sit here in my window seat en route from San Francisco back to Boston on January 9, 2017, from the AI conference we just organized in Asilomar. So let me end this book by sharing my thoughts with you. Maya is catching up on sleep next to me after the many short nights of preparing and organizing. Wow, what a wild week it's been. We managed to bring almost all the people I've mentioned in this book together for a few days to this Puerto Rico sequel, including entrepreneurs such as Elon Musk and Larry Page, and AI research leaders from academia and companies such as DeepMind, Google, Facebook, Apple, IBM, Microsoft, and Baidu, as well as economists, legal scholars, philosophers, and other amazing thinkers. The results superseded even my high expectations, and I'm feeling more optimistic about the future of life than I have in a long time. In this epilogue, I'm going to tell you why. FLI is born. Ever since I learned about the nuclear arms race at age 14, I've been concerned that the power of our technology was growing faster than the wisdom with which we manage it. I therefore decided to sneak a chapter about this challenge into my first book, Our Mathematical Universe, even though the rest of it was primarily about physics. I made a New Year's resolution for 2014 that I was no longer allowed to complain about anything without putting some serious thought into what I could personally do about it, and I kept my pledge during my book tour that January. Maya and I did lots of brainstorming about starting some sort of nonprofit organization focused on improving the future of life through technological stewardship. She insisted that we give it a positive name as different as possible from Doom and Gloom Institute and Let's Worry About the Future Institute. Since Future of Humanity Institute was already taken, we converged on the Future of Life Institute, FLI, which had the added advantage of being more inclusive. On January 22, the book tour took us to Santa Cruz, and as the California sun set over the Pacific, we enjoyed dinner with our old friend Anthony Aguirre and persuaded him to join forces with us. He's not only one of the wisest and most idealistic people I know, but also someone who's managed to put up with running another nonprofit organization, the Foundational Questions Institute. See http://fqxi.org, with me for over a decade. The following week, the tour took me to London. Since the future of AI was very much on my mind, I reached out to Demis Hassabis, who graciously invited me to visit DeepMind's headquarters. I was awestruck by how much they'd grown since he visited me at MIT 2 years earlier. Google had just bought them for about $650 million, and seeing their vast office landscape filled with brilliant minds pursuing Demis's audacious goal to solve intelligence gave me a visceral feeling that success was a real possibility. The next evening, I spoke with my friend Jan Tallinn using Skype, the software he'd helped create. I explained our FLI vision, and an hour later, he'd decided to take a chance on us, funding us at up to $100,000 a year. Few things touch me more than when someone places more trust in me than I've earned, so it meant the world to me when a year later, after the Puerto Rico conference I mentioned in Chapter 1, he joked that this was the best investment he'd ever made. The next day, my publisher had left a gap in my schedule, which I filled with a visit to the London Science Museum. After having obsessed about the past and future of intelligence for so long, I suddenly felt that I was walking through a physical manifestation of my thoughts. They'd assembled a fantastic collection of stuff representing our growth of knowledge, from Stevenson's rocket locomotive to the Model T Ford, a life-size Apollo 11 lunar lander replica, and computers dating all the way from Babbage's difference engine mechanical calculator to present-day hardware. They also had an exhibit about the history of our understanding of the mind, from Galvano's frog leg experiments to neurons, EEG, and fMRI. I very rarely cry, but that's what I did on the way out. And in a tunnel full of pedestrians, no less, en route to the South Kensington Tube Station. Here were all these people going about their lives blissfully unaware of what I was thinking. First, we humans discovered how to replicate some natural processes with machines, making our own wind and lightning, and our own mechanical horsepower. Gradually, we started realizing that our bodies were also machines. Then the discovery of nerve cells started blurring the borderline between body and mind. Then we started building machines that could outperform not only our muscles, but our minds as well. So in parallel with discovering what we are we inevitably making ourselves obsolete? That would be poetically tragic. This thought scared me, but it also strengthened my resolve to keep my New Year's resolution. I felt that we needed one more person to complete our team of FLI founders, who'd spearhead a team of idealistic young volunteers. The logical choice was Victoria Krakowna, a brilliant Harvard grad student who'd not only won a silver medal in the International Mathematics Olympiad, but also founded the Citadel, a house for about a dozen young idealists who wanted reason to play a greater role in their lives and the world. May and I invited her over to our place 5 days later to tell her about our vision. And before we'd finished the sushi, FLI had been born. The Puerto Rico Adventure. This marked the beginning of an amazing adventure, which still continues. As I mentioned in Chapter 1, we held regular brainstorming meetings at our house with dozens of idealistic students, professors, and other local thinkers, where the top-rated ideas transformed into projects, the first being that AI op-ed from Chapter 1 with Stephen Hawking, Stuart Russell, and Frank Wilczek that helped ignite the public debate. In parallel with the baby steps of setting up a new organization, such as incorporating, recruiting an advisory board, and launching a website, we held a fun launch event in front of a packed MIT auditorium, at which Alan Alda explored the future of technology with leading experts. We focused the rest of the year on pulling together the Puerto Rico conference, which, as I mentioned in Chapter 1, aimed to engage the world's leading AI researchers in the discussion of how to keep AI beneficial. Our goal was to shift the AI safety conversation from worrying to working, from bickering about how worried to be, to agreeing on concrete research projects that could be started right away to maximize the chance of a good outcome. To prepare, we collected promising AI safety research ideas from around the world and sought community feedback on our growing project list. With the help of Stuart Russell and a group of hardworking young volunteers, especially Daniel Dewey, Janos Kramar, and Richard Mala, we distilled these research priorities into a document to be discussed at the conference. Building consensus that there was lots of valuable AI safety research to be done would, we hoped, encourage people to start doing such research. The ultimate moonshot triumph would be if it could even persuade someone to fund it, since, so far, there had been essentially no support for such work from government funding agencies. Enter Elon Musk. On August 2, he appeared on our radar by famously tweeting, "Worth reading Superintelligence by Bostrom. We need to be super careful with AI, potentially more dangerous than nukes." I reached out to him about our efforts and got to speak with him by phone a few weeks later. Although I felt quite nervous and starstruck, the outcome was outstanding. He agreed to join our FLI Scientific Advisory Board, to attend our conference, and potentially to fund a first-ever AI safety research program to be announced in Puerto Rico. This electrified all of us at FLI and made us redouble our efforts to create an awesome conference, identify promising research topics, and build community support for them. I finally got to meet Elon in person for further planning when he came to MIT 2 months later for a space symposium. It felt very strange to be alone with him in a small green room just moments after he'd enraptured over 1,000 MIT students like a rock star. But after a few minutes, all I could think of was our joint project. I instantly liked him. He radiated sincerity, and I was inspired by how much he cared about the long-term future of humanity, and how he audaciously turned his aspiration into actions. He wanted humanity to explore and settle our universe, so he started a space company. He wanted sustainable energy, so he started a solar company and an electric car company. Tall, handsome, eloquent, and incredibly knowledgeable, it was easy to understand why people listened to him. Unfortunately, this MIT event also taught me how fear-driven and divisive media can be. Elon's stage performance consisted of an hour of fascinating discussion about space exploration, which I think would have made great TV. At the very end, a student asked him an off-topic question about AI. His answer included the phrase, "With artificial intelligence, we are summoning the demon," which became the only thing that most media reported, and generally out of context. It struck me that many journalists were inadvertently doing the exact opposite of what we were trying to accomplish in Puerto Rico. Whereas we wanted to build community consensus by highlighting the common ground, the media had an incentive to highlight the divisions. The more controversy they could report, the greater their Nielsen ratings and ad revenue. Moreover, whereas we wanted to help people from across the spectrum of opinions to come together, get along, and understand each other better, media coverage inadvertently made people across the opinion spectrum upset at one another, fueling misunderstandings by publishing only their most provocative-sounding quotes without context. For this reason, we decided to ban journalists from the Puerto Rico meeting and impose the Chatham House Rule, which prohibits participants from subsequently revealing who said what. Although our Puerto Rico conference ended up being a success, it didn't come easy. The countdown mostly required diligent prep work, for example, me phoning or Skyping large numbers of AI researchers to assemble a critical mass of participants to attract the other attendees, and there were also dramatic moments, such as when I got up by 7 a.m. on December 27 to reach Elon on a lousy phone connection to Uruguay and was told, "I don't think this is going to work." He was concerned that an AI safety research program might provide a false sense of security, enabling reckless researchers to forge ahead while paying lip service to safety. But then, despite the sound incessantly cutting out, we extensively talked through the huge benefits of mainstreaming the topic and getting more AI researchers working on AI safety. After the call dropped, he sent me one of my favorite emails ever. Lost the call at the end there. Anyway, docs look fine. I'm happy to support the research with $5 million over 3 years. Maybe we should make it $10 million? 4 days later, 2015 got off to a good start for Maya and me as we briefly relaxed before the meeting, dancing in the new year on a Puerto Rico beach illuminated by fireworks. The conference got off to a great start, too. There was remarkable consensus that more AI safety research was needed, and based on further input from the conference participants, that research priorities document we'd worked so hard on was improved and finalized. We passed around that safety research endorsing open letter from Chapter 1, and were delighted that almost everyone signed it. Maya and I had a magical meeting with Elon in our hotel room, where he blessed the detailed plans for our grants program. She was touched by how down-to-earth and candid he was about his personal life, and how much interest he took in us. He asked us how we met and liked Maya's elaborate story. The next day, we filmed an interview with him about AI safety and why he wanted to support it, and everything seemed on track. The conference climax, Elon's donation announcement, was scheduled for 7 p.m. on Sunday, January 4, 2015, and I'd been so tense about it that I'd tossed and turned in my sleep the night before. And then, just 15 minutes before we were supposed to head to the session where it would happen, we hit a snag. Elon's assistant called and said that it looked like Elon might not be able to go through with the announcement, and Maya said she'd never seen me look more stressed or disappointed. Elon finally came by, and I could hear the seconds counting down to the session start as we sat there and talked. He explained that they were just 2 days away from a crucial SpaceX rocket launch where they hoped to pull off the first ever successful landing of the first stage on a drone ship, and that since this was a huge milestone, the SpaceX team didn't want to distract from it with concurrent media splashes involving him. Anthony Aguirre, cool and level-headed as always, pointed out that this meant that nobody wanted media attention for this, neither Elon nor the AI community. We arrived a few minutes late to the session I was moderating, but we had a plan. No dollar amount would get mentioned to ensure that the announcement wasn't newsworthy, and I'd lord Chatham House over everyone to keep Elon's announcement secret from the world for 9 days if his rocket reached the space station, regardless of whether the landing succeeded. He said he'd need even more time if the rocket exploded on launch. The countdown to the announcement finally reached zero. The superintelligence panelists that I'd moderated still sat there next to me on stage in their chairs. Eliezer Yudkowsky, Elon Musk, Nick Bostrom, Richard Mala, Murray Shanahan, Bart Selman, Shane Legg, and Werner Vinge. People gradually stopped applauding, but the panelists remained seated, because I told them to stay without explaining why. Maya later told me that her pulse reached the stratosphere around now, and that she clutched Victoria Krakovna's calming hand under the table. I smiled, knowing that this was the moment we'd worked, hoped, and waited for. I was very happy that there was such consensus at the meeting that more research was needed for keeping AI beneficial, I said, and that there were so many concrete research directions we could work on right away. But there had been talk of serious risks in this session, I added, so it would be nice to raise our spirits and get into an upbeat mood before heading out to the bar and the conference banquet that had been set up outside. And I'm therefore giving the microphone to Elon Musk. I felt that history was in the making as Elon took the mic and announced that he would donate a large amount of money to AI safety research. Unsurprisingly, he brought down the house. As planned, he didn't mention how much, but I knew that it was a cool $10 million, as we'd agreed. Maya and I went to visit our parents in Sweden and Romania after the conference, and with bated breath, we watched the live-streamed rocket launch with my dad in Stockholm. The landing attempt unfortunately ended with what Elon euphemistically calls an RUD, rapid unscheduled disassembly, and pulling off a successful ocean landing took his team another 15 months. However, all the satellites were successfully launched into orbit, as was our grants program via a tweet by Elon to his millions of followers. Mainstreaming AI safety. A key goal of the Puerto Rico conference had been to mainstream AI safety research, and it was exhilarating to see this unfold in multiple steps. First, there was the meeting itself, where many researchers started feeling comfortable engaging with the topic once they realized that they were part of a growing community of peers. I was deeply touched by encouragement from many participants. For example, Cornell University AI professor Bart Selman emailed me saying, "I've honestly never seen a better organized or more exciting and intellectually stimulating scientific meeting." The next mainstreaming step began on January 11, when Elon tweeted, "World's top artificial intelligence developers sign open letter calling for AI safety research," linking to a sign-up page that soon racked up over 8,000 signatures, including many of the world's most prominent AI builders. It suddenly became harder to claim that people concerned about AI safety didn't know what they were talking about, because this now implied that a who's who of leading AI researchers didn't know what they were talking about. The open letter was reported by media around the world in a way that made us grateful that we'd barred journalists from our conference. Although the most alarmist word in the letter was pitfalls, it nonetheless triggered headlines such as "Elon Musk and Stephen Hawking sign open letter in hopes of preventing robot uprising," illustrated by murderous Terminators. Of the hundreds of articles we spotted, our favorite was one mocking the others, writing that a headline that conjures visions of skeletal androids stomping human skulls underfoot turns complex, transformative technology into a carnival sideshow. Fortunately, there were also many sober news articles, and they gave us another challenge: keeping up with the torrent of new signatures, which needed to be manually verified to protect our credibility and weed out pranks such as HAL 9000, Terminator, Sarah Jeanette Connor, and Skynet. For this and our future open letters, Victoria Krakovna and Janos Kramar helped organize a volunteer brigade of checkers that included Jesse Geliff, Eric Gastfriend, and Revati Vinod Kumar, working in shifts, so that when Revati went to sleep in India, she passed the baton to Eric in Boston, and so on. The third mainstreaming step began 4 days later, when Elon tweeted a link to our announcement that he was donating $10 million to AI safety research. A week later, we launched an online portal where researchers from around the world could apply and compete for this funding. We were able to whip the application system together so quickly only because Anthony and I had spent the previous decade running similar competitions for physics grants. The Open Philanthropy Project, a California-based charity focused on high-impact giving, generously agreed to top up Elon's gift to allow us to give more grants. We weren't sure how many applicants we'd get, since the topic was novel and the deadline was short. The response blew us away, with about 300 teams from around the world asking for about $100 million. A panel of AI professors and other researchers carefully reviewed the proposals and selected 37 winning teams, who were funded for up to 3 years. When we announced the list of winners, it marked the first time that the media response to our activities was fairly nuanced and free of killer robot pictures. It was finally sinking in that AI safety wasn't empty talk. There was actual, useful work to be done, and lots of great research teams were rolling up their sleeves to join the effort. The fourth mainstreaming step happened organically over the next 2 years, with scores of technical publications and dozens of workshops on AI safety around the world, typically as parts of mainstream AI conferences. Persistent people had tried for many years to engage the AI community in safety research with limited success, but now things really took off. Many of these publications were funded by our grants program, and we at FLI did our best to help organize and fund as many of these workshops as we could, but a growing fraction of them were enabled by AI researchers investing their own time and resources. As a result, ever more researchers learned about safety research from their own colleagues, discovering that, aside from being useful, it could also be fun, involving interesting mathematical and computational problems to puzzle over. Complicated equations aren't everyone's idea of fun, of course. 2 years after our Puerto Rico conference, we preceded our Asilomar conference with a technical workshop where our FLI grant winners could showcase their research and watch slide after slide with mathematical symbols on the big screen. Masha Vardy, an AI professor at Rice University, joked that he knew we'd succeeded in establishing an AI safety research field once the meetings got boring. This dramatic growth of AI safety work wasn't limited to academia. Amazon, DeepMind, Facebook, Google, IBM, and Microsoft launched an industry partnership for beneficial AI. Major new AI safety donations enabled expanded research at our largest nonprofit sister organizations, the Machine Intelligence Research Institute in Berkeley, the Future of Humanity Institute in Oxford, and the Center for the Study of Existential Risk in Cambridge, UK. Further donations of $10 million or more kickstarted additional beneficial AI efforts. The Leverhulme Center for the Future of Intelligence in Cambridge, the K&L Gates Endowment for Ethics and Computational Technologies in Pittsburgh, and the Ethics and Governance of Artificial Intelligence Fund in Miami. Last but not least, with a $1 billion commitment, Elon Musk partnered with other entrepreneurs to launch OpenAI, a nonprofit company in San Francisco pursuing beneficial AI. AI safety research was here to stay. In lockstep with this surge of research came a surge of opinions being expressed, both individually and collectively. The industry partnership on AI published its founding tenets, and long reports with lists of recommendations were published by the U.S. government, Stanford University, and the IEEE, the world's largest organization of technical professionals, together with dozens of other reports and position papers from elsewhere. We were eager to facilitate meaningful discussion among the Asilomar attendees and learn what, if anything, this diverse community agreed on. Lucas Perry therefore took on the heroic task of reading all of those documents we'd found and extracting all their opinions. In a marathon effort initiated by Anthony Aguirre and concluded by a series of long telecons, our FLI team then attempted to group similar opinions together and strip away redundant bureaucratic verbiage to end up with a single list of succinct principles, also including unpublished but influential opinions that had been expressed more informally in talks and elsewhere. But this list still included plenty of ambiguity, contradiction, and room for interpretation. So the month before the conference, we shared it with the participants and collected their opinions and suggestions for improved or novel principles. This community input produced a significantly revised principle list for use at the conference. In Asilomar, the list was further improved in two steps. First, small groups discussed the principles they were most interested in, producing detailed refinements, feedback, new principles, and competing versions of old ones. Finally, we surveyed all attendees to determine the level of support for each version of each principle. This collective process was both exhaustive and exhausting, with Anthony, Maya, and I curtailing sleep and lunchtime at the conference and our scramble to compile everything needed in time for the next steps. But it was also exciting. After such detailed, thorny, and sometimes contentious discussions, and such a wide range of feedback, we were astonished by the high level of consensus that emerged around many of the principles during that final survey, with some getting over 97% support. This consensus allowed us to set a high bar for inclusion in the final list. We kept only principles that at least 90% of the attendees agreed on. Although this meant that some popular principles were dropped at the last minute, including some of my personal favorites. It enabled most of the participants to feel comfortable endorsing all of them on the sign-up sheet that we passed around the auditorium. Here's the result. The Asilomar AI Principles. Artificial intelligence has already provided beneficial tools that are used every day by people around the world. Its continued development, guided by the following principles, will offer amazing opportunities to help and empower people in the decades and centuries ahead. Research issues. 1. Research goal. The goal of AI research should be to create not undirected intelligence, but beneficial intelligence. 2. Research funding. Investments in AI should be accompanied by funding for research on ensuring its beneficial use, including thorny questions in computer science, economics, law, ethics, and social studies, such as A. How can we make future AI systems highly robust so that they do what we want without malfunctioning or getting hacked? B. How can we grow our prosperity through automation while maintaining people's resources and purpose? C. How can we update our legal systems to be more fair and efficient, to keep pace with AI, and to manage the risks associated with AI? D. What set of values should AI be aligned with, and what legal and ethical status should it have? 3. Science policy link. There should be constructive and healthy exchange between AI researchers and policymakers. 4. Research culture. A culture of cooperation, trust, and transparency should be fostered among researchers and developers of AI. 5. Race avoidance. Teams developing AI systems should actively cooperate to avoid corner cutting on safety standards. Ethics and values. 6. Safety. AI systems should be safe and secure throughout their operational lifetime, and verifiably so where applicable and feasible. 7. Failure transparency. If an AI system causes harm, it should be possible to ascertain why. 8. Judicial transparency. Any involvement by an autonomous system in judicial decision-making should provide a satisfactory explanation auditable by a competent human authority. 9. Responsibility. Designers and builders of advanced AI systems are stakeholders in the moral implications of their use, misuse, and actions, with a responsibility and opportunity to shape those implications. 10. Value alignment. Highly autonomous AI systems should be designed so that their goals and behaviors can be assured to align with human values throughout their operation. 11. Human values. AI systems should be designed and operated so as to be compatible with ideals of human dignity, rights, freedoms, and cultural diversity. 12. Personal privacy. People should have the right to access, manage, and control the data they generate, given AI systems' power to analyze and utilize that data. 13. Liberty and privacy. The application of AI to personal data must not unreasonably curtail people's real or perceived liberty. 14. Shared benefit. AI technologies should benefit and empower as many people as possible. 15. Shared prosperity. The economic prosperity created by AI should be shared broadly to benefit all of humanity. 16. Human control. Humans should choose how and whether to delegate decisions to AI systems to accomplish human-chosen objectives. 17. Non-subversion. The power conferred by control of highly advanced AI systems should respect and improve, rather than subvert, the social and civic processes on which the health of society depends. 18. AI arms race. An arms race in lethal autonomous weapons should be avoided. Longer term issues. 19. Capability caution. There being no consensus, we should avoid strong assumptions regarding upper limits on future AI capabilities. 20. Importance. Advanced AI could represent a profound change in the history of life on Earth and should be planned for and managed with commensurate care and resources. 21. Risks. Risks posed by AI systems, especially catastrophic or existential risks, must be subject to planning and mitigation efforts commensurate with their expected impact. 22. Recursive self-improvement. AI systems designed to recursively self-improve or self-replicate in a manner that could lead to rapidly increasing quality or quantity must be subject to strict safety and control measures. 23. Common good. Superintelligence should only be developed in the service of widely shared ethical ideals and for the benefit of all humanity, rather than one state or organization. The signature list grew dramatically after we posted the principles online, and by now it includes an amazing list of more than 1,000 AI researchers and many other top thinkers. If you too want to join as a signatory, you can do so here. http://futureoflife.org/AI-principles. We were struck not only by the level of consensus about the principles, but also by how strong they were. Sure, some of them sound about as controversial as peace, love, and motherhood are valuable at first glance, but many of them have real teeth, as is most easily seen by formulating negations of them. For example, superintelligence is impossible, violates number 19, and it's a total waste to do research on reducing existential risk from AI, violates number 21. Indeed, as you can see for yourself if you watch our long-term panel discussion on YouTube, Elon Musk, Stuart Russell, Ray Kurzweil, Demis Hassabis, Sam Harris, Nick Bostrom, David Chalmers, Bart Selman, and Jan Tallinn all agreed that superintelligence would probably be developed and that safety research was important. Mindful optimism. As I confessed in the opening of this epilogue, I'm feeling more optimistic about the future of life than I have in a long time. I shared my personal story to explain why. My experiences over the past few years have increased my optimism for two separate reasons. First, I've witnessed the AI community come together in a remarkable way to constructively take on the challenges ahead, often in collaboration with thinkers from other fields. Elon told me after the Asilomar meeting that he found it amazing how AI safety has gone from a fringe issue to mainstream in only a few years, and I'm just as amazed myself. And now it's not merely the near-term issues from Chapter 3 that are becoming respectable discussion topics, but even superintelligence and existential risk, as in the Asilomar AI principles. There's no way that those principles could have been adopted in Puerto Rico 2 years earlier, where the most scary-sounding word that made it into the open letter was pitfalls. I like people watching, and at one point during the final morning of the Asilomar conference, I stood at the side of the auditorium and watched the participants listen to a discussion about AI and law. To my surprise, a warm and fuzzy feeling swept through me, and I suddenly felt very moved. This felt so different from Puerto Rico. Back then, I remember viewing most of the AI community with a combination of respect and fear. Not exactly as an opposing team, but as a group that my AI-concerned colleagues and I felt we needed to persuade. But now it felt so obvious that we were all on the same team. As you've probably gleaned from listening to this book, I still don't have the answers to how to create a great future with AI, so it feels great to be part of a growing community searching for the answers together. The second reason I've grown more optimistic is that the FLI experience has been empowering. What had triggered my London tears was a feeling of inevitability, that a disturbing future may be coming, and there was nothing we could do about it. But the next 3 years dissolved my fatalistic gloom. If even a ragtag bunch of unpaid volunteers could make a positive difference for what's arguably the most important conversation of our time, then imagine what we can all do if we work together. Erik Brynjolfsson spoke of two kinds of optimism in his Asilomar talk. First, there's the unconditional kind, such as the positive expectation that the sun will rise tomorrow morning. Then there's what he called mindful optimism, which is the expectation that good things will happen if you plan carefully and work hard for them. That's the kind of optimism I now feel about the future of life. So what can you do to make a positive difference for the future of life as we enter the age of AI? For reasons I'll soon explain, I think that a great first step is working on becoming a mindful optimist, if you aren't one already. To be a successful mindful optimist, it's crucial to develop positive visions for the future. When MIT students come to my office for career advice, I usually start by asking them where they see themselves in a decade. If a student were to reply, "Perhaps I'll be in a cancer ward or in a cemetery after getting hit by a bus," I'd give her a hard time. Envisioning only negative futures is a terrible approach to career planning. Devoting 100% of one's efforts to avoiding diseases and accidents is a great recipe for hypochondria and paranoia, not happiness. Instead, I'd like to hear her describe her goals with enthusiasm, after which we can discuss strategies for getting there while avoiding pitfalls. Erik pointed out that, according to game theory, positive visions form the foundation of a large fraction of all collaboration in the world, from marriages and corporate mergers to the decision of independent states to form the USA. After all, why sacrifice something you have if you can't imagine the even greater gain that this will provide? This means that we should be imagining positive futures, not only for ourselves, but also for society and for humanity itself. In other words, we need more existential hope. Yet, as Maya likes to remind me, from Frankenstein to the Terminator, futuristic visions in literature and film are predominantly dystopian. In other words, we as a society are planning our future about as poorly as that hypothetical MIT student. This is why we need more mindful optimists. And this is why I've encouraged you throughout this book to think about what sort of future you want, rather than merely what sort of future you fear, so that we can find shared goals to plan and work for. We've heard throughout this book how AI is likely to give us both grand opportunities and tough challenges. A strategy that's likely to help with essentially all AI challenges is for us to get our act together and improve our human society before AI fully takes off. We're better off educating our young to make technology robust and beneficial before ceding great power to it. We're better off modernizing our laws before technology makes them obsolete. We're better off resolving international conflicts before they escalate into an arms race in autonomous weapons. We're better off creating an economy that ensures prosperity for all before AI potentially amplifies inequalities. We're better off in a society where AI safety research results get implemented rather than ignored. And looking further ahead, to challenges related to superhuman AGI, we're better off agreeing on at least some basic ethical standards before we start teaching these standards to powerful machines. In a polarized and chaotic world, people with the power to use AI for malicious purposes will have more motivation and ability to do so. And teams racing to build AGI will feel more pressure to cut corners on safety than to cooperate. In summary, if we can create a more harmonious human society, characterized by cooperation toward shared goals, this will improve the prospects of the AI revolution ending well. In other words, one of the best ways for you to improve the future of life is to improve tomorrow. You have power to do so in many ways. Of course, you can vote at the ballot box and tell your politicians what you think about education, privacy, lethal autonomous weapons, technological unemployment, and other issues. But you also vote every day through what you choose to buy, what news you choose to consume, what you choose to share, and what sort of role model you choose to be. Do you want to be someone who interrupts all their conversations by checking their smartphone, or someone who feels empowered by using technology in a planned and deliberate way? Do you want to own your technology, or do you want your technology to own you? What do you want it to mean to be human in the age of AI? Please discuss all this with those around you. It's not only an important conversation, but a fascinating one. We're the guardians of the future of life now, as we shape the age of AI. Although I cried in London, I now feel that there's nothing inevitable about this future, and I know that it's much easier to make a difference than I thought. Our future isn't written in stone and just waiting to happen to us. It's ours to create. Let's create an inspiring one together. This is Rob Shapiro. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of Life 3.0, Being Human in the Age of Artificial Intelligence by Max Tegmark. This program was directed by Arthur G. Insana. Executive producer, Aaron Blank. Text copyright 2017 by Max Tegmark. Production copyright 2017, Penguin Random House, LLC. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.